Welcome to Giving an Answer, the show dedicated to defending the historic Christian faith. I am your host, Harold Felder, and today we're going to talk about the archaeological evidence for the New Testament. And with me to discuss this, I have Dr. Scott Matchers. Let me tell you a little bit about Scott. Scott has an undergraduate degree in biblical studies. He has a Master's of Divinity from Southern Evangelical Seminary and a Doctor of Ministry from Southern Evangelical Seminary also. And for those of you who are watching, you may say, well, I've already seen this show. No, you haven't. You may have seen the show where we did the archaeological evidence for the Old Testament. But Scott has agreed to come on again and do the archaeological evidence for the New Testament. So that's what we're going to talk about. And for those who weren't here for that last show, Scott, what is archaeology?
Well, archaeology, Harold, is simply the scientific study of past civilizations.
Okay. That's what I like about Scott. He's right, direct, to the point. Does archaeology prove the Bible?
Well, it proves it indirectly. It doesn't prove it in the sense of a mathematical formula where, you know, 2 + 2 = 4 or something like that. But it does prove that we can trust the documents, that they're reliable and they're historical.
Okay. So let's get to it. Now show some of the evidence that corroborates the New Testament.
Okay, well, three of the things that archaeology can do for the Bible is it can clarify the meaning of some scripture passages, it can illuminate the original cultures for us, and it affirms the historical basis of the Bible. So one of the interesting finds they find regarding the New Testament is what they call the temple notice. This is one of several that were placed at the temple entrances, and it was used during the first century AD. It was written in Greek, and literally it's a keep-off sign to warn the Gentiles.
And to warn the Gentiles for what?
To keep off the Temple Mount.
Oh.
So, and it actually says in the translation to English, it says, no stranger is to enter within the balustrade round the temple and enclosure. Whoever is caught is responsible to himself and for his death, which will ensue.
Whoa. It doesn't say the penalty may be death.
That's right.
It's like you will be killed.
That's exactly right.
God's holy.
Yes, that's right. And they were trying to, you know, to keep the Gentiles out from defiling the temple.
Right, right, right.
And so the importance of this find is that it illuminates the culture and it illustrates the vast separation between the Jews and the Gentiles.
You know, I know this is a side note, and I'm only going to touch on it briefly, but that reminds me of the story where Paul brought, who was that? Someone into the temple, and maybe it was Mark. Mm. Well, and so the Jews got really, really, really offended because they were like, this Gentile, he's bringing a Gentile into the temple. So this is a good indication of what the mind frame was then. I mean, that was so serious, the idea of a Jew bringing in the temple, that the penalty of it was death, for it was death.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I did think about using that passage on here, but I was trying to keep it short. But that's
okay.
Exactly right.
Okay. See,
you're right on target, Harold.
All right. I get it right every now and then.
That's right.
I don't just sit here. I'm not just a pretty face.
No.
Well, we all know I'm not just a pretty face. Okay. We all know I'm not a pretty face, period. But all right, go, as you were saying.
Okay. The next interesting thing is the Pontius Pilate inscription. And the Latin inscription gives his title as Pontius Pilate, Prefect of Judea. And this is a reproduction of the inscription at Caesarea Maritima. And you can see the Pilatus in Latin on the inscription.
So this is verifiable evidence that Pontius Pilate was a historical person.
Yeah, exactly.
All of those people that are talked about in the New Testament are historical people, and we have evidence to back that up. That's good. That's very good evidence.
That's right. Yeah, we have physical evidence, you know, to back up a lot of the different names of people in the New Testament.
And I think that's important because if we can trust it as far as the historical evidence, then why can't we trust it as far as the other things? Why can't we trust it as far as the account of Jesus and his life?
That's right, and that's why Jesus said that, you know, if I tell you, you know, earthly things, and if you can trust the earthly things I tell you, then you can also likewise trust the heavenly things I tell you about.
Right. Sorry, I distracted you. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's okay. So this gives physical evidence from the time of Jesus that Pontius Pilate was the prefect of Judea. And it's reminiscent of Luke 3:1, where it says, now in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, when Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea. And it testifies to us that the gospel writers were accurate in their details. Mm-hmm. So another thing regarding Pontius Pilate that is readily available are these coins that he minted. And there's what the coin looks like today. And it says on the coin, Pontius Pilate, procurator of Judea.
So it actually says that on, so there's no doubt that he was the procurator of Judea because that is very clear on the printed on the coin itself.
Yeah, and then on this side of the coin here, you can actually see at the top there, it says Tiberion, which is saying that he's the emperor of Tiberius.
All right. Great.
So the importance of this find is it gives additional evidence to us regarding Pontius Pilate and that he was the ruler of Judea. So another interesting find that they found not that long ago in the 1980s was a first century fishing boat. The water had receded in the Sea of Galilee during an unusually severe drought, and then they found the remains of this boat and that was 26 feet long and 7.5 feet wide. So they spent a lot of time and effort and money recovering it, and so this is it now preserved in a museum. You can see it in Israel. There's a close-up of it, and so you can see it's all made out of wood, and then the metal framework is just to keep it in place so it doesn't get damaged.
Okay.
It spent 10 years in a chemical bath to keep it from deteriorating.
Wow.
And this is what the boat would have looked like probably in the open sea there.
As we discussed when we were going over this, they probably didn't have that tire on the end of it when Jesus was actually in the boat.
No, that's not a first century tire, Harold.
Right. I know Firestone has been around for a while, but not that long.
That's right.
All right.
So now the importance of this find is it shows what the boats looked like that Jesus used and the disciples, you know, when they would go fishing or whatever. And it helps illuminate the New Testament accounts for us. So it brings them to life, you know. Now here is an archaeological find. It's Herod's family tomb. It was discovered in 1892, and it was probably used for the members of Herod's family. Herod himself was probably buried in the Herodium and not here, as Josephus testifies to.
Who's Josephus? I mean,
Josephus was a Roman historian.
Okay.
It was a historian.
Jewish
historian, right. During the time of Jesus.
Right.
And then here is a close-up of what the tomb entrance looked like, and you can see the rolling stone off to the left of the entrance. The stone is 5.2 feet in diameter and 2.5 feet thick, and it's almost perfectly preserved. And you can see how it would be rolled in front of the entrance.
Right. And I can see how once that is rolled there, it's going to stay there.
Yes.
You don't just move that, roll it back up.
That's right. It would be very difficult to move, and especially it would probably be impossible to move perhaps from the inside.
Right, right, right. Good point.
And then here's another rolling stone tomb that has been chipped away, and so it's defaced somewhat, but you can still see that there's another example of it. And there's what the stone looks like from the side. This is a first century style tomb, and this one was built by and for Queen Helene of Adiabene. And this is the interior shot of it looking out, and you can see part of the rolling stone on the right side of the screen. And inside one of the tombs, it could typically look like this with different shafts that bodies would be laid in, and then put a stone slab in front of the
main entrance to it.
Well, in each of the shafts, they would put
a
stone.
Because I thought this was like one big tomb with separate little compartments in it. Is that what this
Yeah,
is?
So you would go into the main entrance, and then you would see something like this in many of the tombs.
Okay, okay. But the main entrance would have the rolling stone in front of it.
That's right.
Okay, I got you.
Now, the importance of this find is it gives credence to the New Testament accounts of the burial of Jesus in a tomb in which a large stone was rolled in place. So there's no doubting that people did use rolling stones, and they are on, you know, you can find them today.
Right.
Okay, and a very interesting thing that was found in 1968 is the remains of a crucifixion victim. It was found in a suburb of Jerusalem in an ossuary from near the time of Jesus. The man had been given a proper Jewish burial, and they analyzed the skeletal remains, and it was determined that he died in his 30s. And this is important because he was crucified during the administration of Pontius Pilate, who we spoke of.
Hmm. So we know that during the time of Pontius Pilate, there were crucifixions that were done under his watch.
That's exactly right. And this is perhaps what they would have actually done during a crucifixion. They would have nailed the person's legs or ankles onto each side of the pillar, and then they would pound the stake or spike through the ankle after going through a piece of olive wood so that it would not pull the body wouldn't pull off of the nail.
Now this raises a question that, I mean, you may not know the answer to this, but I was listening to someone today on the radio, and they were talking about crucifixions, and they were talking about how the Romans weren't just trying to kill you, they were trying to humiliate you. And one of the things they actually did was take off all your clothes. Now that picture that you just showed, that guy had on no clothes. Now, the pictures that we see of Christ, Christ has on some clothes, and I'm wondering if that's just for modesty for our sake. When he was actually crucified, I wonder if he actually had on any clothes at all.
Yeah, it very well could be that he didn't.
Right. Interesting.
And now this is a close-up of what the spikes in the ankles could have looked like, in, you know, in at least in this crucifixion victim's case. And here is the actual artifact that was found. You can see the heel bone with the spike going through it, and there were fragments of olive wood found between the head of the spike and the bone, so that they knew that they used an olive wood piece of olive wood to.
And Yohanan, that's the name. That's who they've actually named the guy.
Or? Well, we do know his actual name because it was on the ossuary.
Okay, so that was his name.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right. And then here's two more shots of the artifact. And you can see, you know, that would be a gruesome way to. To die. I mean, it would be very painful. And here's a reconstruction of how it would have looked anatomically. The right heel bone had fragments of the olive wood, so that they knew that they used the olive wood, as I said. And this is the ossuary that they actually found the bones in.
Okay.
So, and then you can see that there's an inscription on there, and here's a close-up of the inscription in Aramaic, and it says, Yehohanan ben Hagalgal. So it's talking, you know, has his first name, the son of Hagalgal. Now, the importance of this find is it graphically shows the brutal practice of crucifixion by the Romans, and it utterly disproves the claims of some scholars who once said that the Gospel's description of crucifixion with nails was inaccurate. Because some people had said that, you know, they didn't use nails. They, you know, they always tied hands and feet, you know, to the beams, but they didn't.
Isn't that, I think Jehovah's Witnesses actually believe that along those lines. They believe that Jesus was crucified on a stake or something like that. He wasn't actually crucified in the traditional way that we can understand that.
Yeah, they say a crucifixion, you know, stake, you know, so it was just like just an upright beam.
Right.
But you know, the Romans didn't do the exact same thing every time, so there are different instances where they were crucified on different types of crosses and things.
Okay.
So some people did have their hands or feet tied, and then other people had nails in them. But this proves that they did use nails, in spite of the claims of others that said they didn't. Okay, another important ossuary that was found is Caiaphas's ossuary. This ossuary has the inscription Caiaphas, which was found in a monumental tomb in Jerusalem. And as you know, Caiaphas was the high priest who presided over the Jewish part of the trial of Jesus. He was the leader of the Sanhedrin from AD 18 to 36.
So this is definitely in line with the scriptures, with the New Testament accounts.
That's exactly right. And this was found not that long ago in 1990 only. And it also contained the bones of several people, but one of the sets of bones that it contained was a 60-year-old man, so that's thought to be Caiaphas. And here's what the inscription looks like.
Yeah, no doubt about that, Caiaphas.
And yeah, there's a close-up, so you see it a little better. Okay, and the importance of this find, as you already said, is that it strengthens the trustworthiness of the biblical record, because Caiaphas was the high priest, you know, that was on the scene during Jesus' crucifixion and trial.
Right.
Okay, another interesting thing you can see today is the Arch of Titus over in Rome. This was created in 81 AD to honor Titus and Vespasian for their victories in the Judean War, specifically the conquest of Jerusalem in 70 AD. So this is a very, you know, a big monument. It's some 45 to 50 feet high. And
that's a famous landmark, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's just right outside the Colosseum. In this shot, you can see the Colosseum in the background. So if you go to Rome today, you know, that'll be one of the things you see. And then here's one of the inside part of the arch. You can see that it's part of the triumphal procession in 71 AD as the Romans return with their spoils from, you know, Jerusalem. And you can see specifically pictured here the table of showbread, the menorah, and the silver trumpets being carried away in victory. And here's a closer picture, and you can see the different things that they're carrying. You can see the trumpets on the right and the...
The trumpets from the temple, the trumpets that are clearly described in the Old Testament.
Yep, exactly, and there they are, and the Romans had them, and this is what they looked like.
Now, what were you telling me about the menorah there? About that, that's the only way that we know what it actually looked like?
Yeah, there are several other places where there's inscriptions or, you know, real simple drawings of the menorah, but this is, you know, the best one that was carved by the Romans because they actually had the object.
Right.
And the artist saw it, and they created it exactly the way it was, you know.
So that's how we know what a menorah is supposed to look like today.
That's right. That yeah, we know what the one in the temple looked like. You know, right. there are smaller ones in different varieties, but this is what the one in the temple looked like.
Right. And they would know.
Yeah, and then there's another shot of it. Okay, now the importance of this find is, you know, it shows the sacred items that were looted from the temple in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
So in 70 AD, which is a well-tested fact in history. Now, speaking of the trumpets, as you did, they found this interesting inscription called the trumpeting inscription. So on the left shot there, you know, that's what basically the walls would have looked like, and that's the current walls, but, you know, they were rebuilt after destruction. And there's what the reproduction of the inscription looks like. And at the top of the one corner of the temple, there was a large stone that had a niche in it where the priest would stand and sound the trumpet. And here's the actual inscription, and it says, to the place of trumpeting. Mm. And in Josephus, the historian we mentioned, he wrote in one of his books, at the point where it was the custom for one of the priests to stand and to give notice by sound of trumpet in the afternoon of the approach and on the following evening of the close of every seventh day, announcing to the people the respective hours for ceasing work and for resuming their labors. Mm. So Josephus is talking about, you know, the place where the guy would blow the trumpet, you know, on that portion of the Temple Mount.
Right.
So the importance of this find is that it indicates the location where the priests blew their trumpets, announcing the beginnings of holy festivals, as we see in Psalm 81:3. And it helps us to better understand the temple practices, and it also goes a long way to confirm the biblical passages.
Right.
Now, if you go to the Sinai Peninsula today, you can go to St. Catherine's Monastery. And here's a shot of it, surrounded by the mountains of Sinai. This is sitting at the base of the mountain Jebel Musa, which is traditional Mount Sinai, which rises up to nearly 7,500 feet in elevation. This chapel, the chapel that is at this site, was built by Queen Helena in 330 AD. And here's what the monastery looks like today. And if you go there, you can actually go into the monastery and talk to the people. And here's one of the monks studying from their vast collection of manuscripts. And they actually have the second largest and best collection of biblical manuscripts in the whole world, second only to the Vatican. Hmm. They have 3,000 manuscripts as well as miniatures.
So actual New Testament manuscripts?
Yes. Yeah, in different languages and different, you know, forms and codexes and things. And one of the most important manuscripts ever found was discovered here by Tischendorf in 1844, and it's called the Codex Sinaiticus. And here's what the view looks like from the top of Jebel Musa if you climb up it.
I take it you didn't take that picture.
Yeah, yeah, well, it's not that hard to climb up it. It just takes a couple
hours. You took that picture?
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
From there, you can't take a bad picture.
It looks like it's taken from a helicopter or something.
Well, that's because we're standing on the very top of the 7,500-foot mountain looking out at the smaller ones.
Wow.
Yeah. And there's actually a monastery up at the top, a little chapel that they built. So it's very interesting to go there.
How many times have you been to the Holy Land?
I've been to there three times.
Wow.
But I studied in Israel for a while, and so I studied as many archaeological sites as I could while I was there.
That's why you have so many pictures.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, great.
Now, this is an actual photograph of Codex Sinaiticus, and this was it was originally written in the 4th century AD, so...
So what's the significance of that manuscript?
Well, it's the earliest manuscript of the complete New Testament and the earliest witness for some of the Old Testament. So it shows how, if we compare that to what we have today, it shows how accurate our translations have been over the years.
Okay. Okay.
And there's you can see the Greek writing in it, and this is from the Gospel of Mark. And this is in the British Museum over in England now. Now, the importance of this find is, as I said, it's one of the earliest surviving and best-preserved manuscripts of the Bible, and it verifies the accuracy of the New Testament as it has been handed down to us.
Right.
Okay, in approximately 550 AD, some people created what is known today as the Medeba map. It's in a small town called Medeba, which is 20 miles south of present-day Amman, Jordan. It's in a floor of a Byzantine church, and it was probably built during the reign of Emperor Justinian. It's the oldest map of the Holy Land in Jerusalem that still exists today. And here's a picture of the city of Jerusalem, the walled city of Jerusalem, and you can see the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in it, and the way the Cardo runs, and the main street is what that is, and you could tell many different important archaeological things from this.
Yeah, you can see streets, you can see certain buildings, and...
Yeah, and if, you know, archaeologists who have studied this know exactly which building is which and, you know, what it was and things like that. And here's a clear shot of a lot more of the map, so you can see Jerusalem surrounded by the other areas of Israel. Now, the importance of this find, as I said, it's the oldest surviving map of Jerusalem in the Holy Land, but it shows the locations of places where many important biblical events occurred. So a scholar may not know where a particular city was because there's no records of it anymore, because, you know, there's no longer a city there. There would just be a mound, you know, of the civilization that had been there, or the town or the city. And they would look at a map like this and say, okay, now this is where, you know, that city should be. So then this will also help them find a particular locations.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and as we said, you know, all these different things prove to us or help show that, you know, the Bible's reliable. And a rabbi, Nelson Gluck, had said, he was an expert archaeologist, he had said, as a matter of fact, however, it may be stated categorically that no archaeological discovery has ever controverted a biblical reference. Scores of archaeological findings have been made which confirm in clear outline or in exact detail historical statements in the Bible.
Great. That's powerful. That's powerful.
That's exactly right. And he wasn't saying that because he was trying to prove the Bible. You know, a lot of these archaeologists don't believe the Bible necessarily. They're coming as skeptics, and some of them, in fact, have over the years have tried to disprove the Bible, and that's why they were studying archaeology.
Yeah. And some of them who were trying to disprove the Bible actually came to faith because of the stuff that they discovered while they were trying to disprove the Bible.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
If you try to disprove the Bible, you're more likely to embrace the Bible.
Okay. Those are some good. You got any more? Or?
I do have some more I can show you.
Great.
One of the things that, you know, you find easily today is different coins over in Israel. You know, you can buy these, and, you know, they're very common. And so the coins were often like a would tell you the news of different things happening, who was the governor, who was the king now, or different things that had happened. So it was sort of like reading a miniature newspaper, so it would tell you the events of the day.
They didn't have CNN.
No, they didn't. And so this particular find was what they call a hoard of coins, and these were shekels from Tyre. So someone found all of these, like in this piece of pottery that was buried. So somebody probably had all these and they hid them and buried them or something. And then maybe their house was destroyed. No. So their house may have been destroyed or something. So then no one ever found these until centuries later, or, you know, several thousand years later, when archaeologists came and discovered them. And then here is one specific coin that it's a Roman coin with an image of a pig on it. And as you know, to the Jews, the pig was an unclean animal, and they were forbidden to eat it.
Right.
So for the Jews, this particular coin would symbolize all the detestable practices of Roman culture. So, you know, Jews wouldn't necessarily want to carry this Roman coin around with a pig, you know,
and
use it. So, you know, it was sort of like the Romans were, you know, perhaps doing it to irritate the Jews.
Yeah, it's a slap in the face.
Yeah, exactly. And another interesting coin here is the denarius of Tiberius, which was minted from 14 to 37 AD. And from the biblical passage, Pharisees, as you remember, tried to trap Jesus, and they asked, "Tell us then, what do you think? Is it lawful to give a poll tax to Caesar or not?" But Jesus perceived their malice and said, "Why are you testing me, you hypocrites? Show me the coin used for the poll tax." And they brought him a denarius. And this is an actual denarius. Now, there were different ones minted at the time, so they weren't all identical to this one.
Right.
But this very well could have been the exact type of coin that Jesus was referring to. So then he replied and said to them, "Whose likeness and inscription is this?" They said to him, "Caesar's." Then he said to them, "Then render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." And that's from Matthew 22.
Yeah, it takes me back. That's good.
Yeah. And then here's another interesting coin from 71 AD. It's They call it the Judea Capta coin. It was struck in Rome in 71 AD to commemorate the Roman victory over Judea. And if you look at the coin on the right side there, you see the Roman soldier standing there, basically, you know, dominating over top of the small Jewish, you know, a settler there. So as you see, the Roman standing upright behind a mourning woman symbolizing defeated Judea. And the inscription on the coin, on the left side it says Judea, and on the right side it says Capta, which literally means captured Judea.
So yeah, no doubt about the commemoration for this coin. We know exactly why this coin was minted and yeah. what it conveys.
That's exactly right. And then the destruction of Jerusalem was in 70 AD, and then just 1 year later they had this coin minted.
Right. Great.
And that's about all of the photos.
Okay. Okay, I mean, that's been, how did you get so involved in this? I mean, what excited you about this so much that you dedicated so much of your time toward this?
Well, I just find it fascinating, and, you know, a lot of people, you know, at our seminary or other seminaries are just interested in the historical evidence, you know, the archaeology, because you can use it as evidence for why we trust the Bible today. You know, it shows that the records we have are reliable and historical, and that they can be trusted and believed.
Okay. Well, Scott, that actually is going to take us out today.
All right.
I want to thank you very much for coming on again. Scott, Dr. Scott Madras. That will end this episode of Giving an Answer. Be sure to join me again next time. And until then, goodbye and God bless.